It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up on Central Time, we continue our brand new summer music series, Setlist, where we hear interviews and exclusive musical performances from Wisconsin artists. Today, we feature a rock band with Eau Claire roots, Arrow Flynn.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news, the Wisconsin News Roundup.
State government dominated the headlines this week as both the Senate and Assembly passed the biennial state budget. We'll get the latest on what is included and what happens next.
And we'll preview Governor Walker's announcement this coming Monday, where he's expected to declare his candidacy for the 2016 presidential race.
Right now, Mary Spacuzza joins us to talk about these and other stories from around the state this week. Mary, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So after months of deliberations, both chambers of the legislature finally passed the state budget this week. How did it finally happen?
Well, the Senate ended up taking the budget first. We had been told that the Assembly was going to, but the Senate came in on Tuesday and had quite a marathon-length session. Then it headed quickly to the Assembly, who passed it on Wednesday, and then we were here yesterday talking about the 20-week abortion ban. So it's been a busy week at the Capitol.
So were there any changes to the budget from what passed through the Joint Finance Committee?
Yes. So there was quite a backlash to the open records provisions that were inserted at the very end of the Joint Finance Committee's process. Those were all stripped out. Announced it last weekend that they were coming out, and that's continued to be in the news through this week with different leaders in both houses and the governor's office all acknowledging that they had been involved in that process. That came out. We also saw the addition of prevailing wage and essentially overhauling the state's prevailing wage law. That was added by the Senate, and then those same provisions were passed by the Assembly. So, yes, we did see some changes.
And so looking at that prevailing wage rollback, how was that inserted back into the budget?
So it was actually the effort was led by Senator Frank Lissay. They called it the Lissay Plan, and it's not a full repeal, but it does dramatically roll back Wisconsin's law.
So it seems like a long time ago that Governor Walker first proposed his version of the budget. It was back in February. How does this current budget differ from the one that he proposed?
There are certainly some changes. They had cut back slightly on the cuts to higher education and the UW system, I think as $50 million less than he had originally proposed. They added some money back to public schools. They changed his plan for long-term care, family care, and IRIS. There were some changes to his stewardship proposal in terms of public lands and the State Department of Natural Resources buying land. But I think it also, you know, there were a lot of things that it kept too. His voucher expansion is still in there. There are no property tax increases. He was very firm about not wanting to see a vehicle fee increase or anything that would be considered a tax increase. And so those basic principles still remain in his budget.
So the next stop for that budget is Governor Walker's desk for signature. The Wisconsin governor has a lot of editing and veto power that many other governors don't have. Are there ideas of how he may use that veto pen?
Yeah, there are. And he obviously doesn't have a ton of time because he said that he wants to sign the budget before he announces his plans for 2016, which will be in just a few days. But likely, we all expect he's going to sign it this weekend. Presumably, he has, you know, over the last month, he and his staffers have been preparing their vetoes and deciding what they're going to veto. I think a lot of people are thinking he might veto out the payday lender provisions that were added into the budget, and those would expand the just kind of the payday lending industry here in Wisconsin. There was also something added, a provision that would essentially help the Enbridge energy pipeline go through the state. It's been stalled with Dane County and some issues about insurance. There's some speculation that could be vetoed too.
As you just mentioned, Mary, the State Assembly also passed a ban on abortions after 20 weeks yesterday. What are the specifics of that law?
That one was previously passed by the Senate, so that also heads to the governor's desk. That has no exemptions for rape or incest or the health of the mother. The only exemption in that one is if the mother's life is at immediate risk.
And in a preview of the big story next week, Governor Walker is expected to announce his campaign for the presidency on Monday. What do we know or what don't we know about his announcement so far?
We know it's planned for Waukesha on Monday evening. I think that this has been long speculated that he would be getting in the 2016 race, so I don't know that anybody is too shocked by it, but he does seem to be going to the same place where he had his recall party when he won in 2012, and I think a lot of us are expecting to hear a message that he's not just a Republican who can fight, but he is a Republican who can fight and win, and will likely point to his attempted recall and his success in that election, and that being, you know, he's been elected 3 times in recent years.
And I believe there was a video released within the last week or so that is titled Recall the Recall, really playing on that theme.
Yes, it had. It showed footage of the protests, the Capitol Rotunda being packed, the protest signs targeting him, some pretty dramatic music, and it certainly seemed to highlight that fight that he had weathered a few years ago.
And how much of a campaign team has he already assembled?
A really pretty vast one, considering that he's not and has not been an official candidate, but he really has quite a political team assembled, and a lot of campaign veterans, Rick Wiley, others. He's really been staffing up, I would say, since January.
And do we know what his plans are for first campaign stops? They're often pretty symbolic.
Yes, he is. He's really hitting the road pretty promptly after Waukesha. He is planning a tour in those, you know, just Tuesday, I think, alone. He'll be launching a tour that morning and is planning on early primary states, kind of Super Tuesday states. I think he is showing how important Iowa is to him.
Mary Spacuzza, thanks so much for taking time to talk with us today.
Sure, thank you.
That was Mary Spacuzza, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, helping us review the biggest stories from around the state this week for our Wisconsin News Roundup.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
We continue our new summer music series called Setlist. We invited Wisconsin artists into the WPR studios for interviews and exclusive musical performances. You can hear them every Friday at this time until Labor Day weekend.
With members from Eau Claire and Minneapolis, rock band Errol Flynn has strong roots in the Wisconsin music scene. Songwriter and frontman Josh Scott assembled friends from previous projects to help complete the band's self-titled debut, which was recorded at Justin Vernon's studio in rural Chippewa Valley.
We caught up with the band recently and talked about the magic of the Eau Claire music scene and the debut album that almost didn't happen. Errol Flynn, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio today.
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, Josh, let's start at the beginning. As you grew up in Rochester, Minnesota, how did you end up in the blossoming, now almost legendary Eau Claire music scene?
Random college visit, and then ended up kind of going with my band at the time. We all decided on that university for some reason. There was no mystical element to it. It was just close to Rochester.
No, the band at the time, what was that band?
Dinner with Greg. Two G's.
Two G's. On which end?
Greg Gug.
Greg Gug.
We were young, naive, and hungry, and I think we immediately just kind of started playing. I played everywhere and tried to meet young and old, people of the music scene, and I noticed all of this hungry, musicianship that was happening up there.
It seems like it was a really promiscuous scene.
Very.
I could use that in a
creepy
way.
We weren't at first. We were pretty defiant being ourselves, but outsiders. But eventually that kind of leaked into different camps and everyone was playing with each other.
So tell me about the band, Errol Flynn, and the people you've gathered to play on this album and to tour with you.
Yeah, there was a quite eclectic bunch of people that played on the record itself. I think the advantage of recording in Eau Claire, specifically I think at April Base, is that there's always people kind of there in the moment. And I was given the opportunity to record quite a bit there, like a week, a month, for like a year. And so every time we would go, there'd be a different set of personnel that we could kind of take advantage of. And people wanted to come. People came out of the woodwork kind of for this record too, which is really an awesome thing and very humbling for me to see. But, you know, there's always the core, like me and Adam Hurlbert and Justin Vernon. We're always like the three always there. And then we kind of just surrounded ourselves with anyone that was at the studio kind of in a weird way. But yeah, and the live incarnation right now is kind of taken from that, or drawn from that same kind of Eau Claire scene, where it's Adam and me and Dave Power as a trio. So that means we're a five piece as well.
Now, reading what people have said about you and the early days in Eau Claire, Chris Porterfield, Field Report, who we've also talked to in the
Dinner
series.
Dinner with Greg alum.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, he was in that early band,
yeah.
Too.
Yeah.
Well, it seems like there was a perception that you were the guy in this scene, that you were the one who's going to make it big, and maybe they could all ride on your coattails. Chris Porterfield, in that thing I mentioned on your website, says, this is a long-awaited record, deferred. Music deferred in a lot of ways. So what happened between now and then in that hiatus?
Yeah, I mean, I think I definitely was at that point. I felt like I was kind of leading the brigade of everybody that was there, and I had really kind of irrational confidence in myself at that point, where nothing could stand in the way. And so in that way, I thought everything would kind of come together. I sort of saw like a limit in Eau Claire in the moment when I was living there, and I thought I needed to get out. And so Chicago seemed like the great city to go to in that moment. And so I kind of just let it all go, and just figuring I would figure it out down the way. But that just kind of, I realized how much I need the communal element of playing and the family and like the local scene to help elevate where I need to be.
Do you feel like musically anyway alone in Chicago?
Very. Oh, absolutely. And a lot of that was just more self-doubt and depression, things like that. But it was only like, in a weird way, like going back, that I was able to like find confidence again in that way.
And people have referred, you mentioned depression, people have referred to this project as therapeutic for you. Is it?
Yeah, it absolutely was, because when I started that first like day of recording, I mean, it was amazing to me that I had, you know, it was like a chunk of me that I hadn't been exercise in a while, and I realized how fast I could, like, I was coming back to life in a weird way just by being in a studio in that kind of environment with people I know and trust. And it was this beautiful thing to take me out of the shell I was in Chicago. So I took all of your earrings and your
mentioned while you're in Chicago, you were writing overtime, writing less music, not feeling, I guess, the inspiration there. But in that time, did you have this bank of music that we're just starting to hit the tip of the iceberg on now?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was always writing, but I used to really pride myself in how much I could write in a very like Bob Dylan way or something, where I could just write all the time, you know. And that slowly started to go away, and the first song on the record that we put out here is like kind of the first amazing kind of moment where I could just start writing again. And that was happening during the course of the record, because all the songs on the record are pretty much written during the time I was recording.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So wait, you've got a bank of
older
scores,
like,
of songs that don't even show up on this album.
Yeah. That probably won't come out ever, but yeah.
Ever.
Well, I don't know when I want to, at old age, when I want to be a songwriter again, a singer songwriter. Yeah.
That's amazing. I mean, So is it that you've changed your attitude toward those songs? They felt timely and compelling than they don't now? Or you're just in a different
place?
I
didn't have any fun kind of writing those anymore. They were, in a weird way, they were really effortless for me to write. And that was going back to the Dinner with Craig, to Amateur Love Days, where I could write those kinds of songs really fast. And they were almost too easy for me to write. And I think I became very disgusted with that way of writing, and where it was, I wanted to find something that was challenging, but something that just challenged me personally, and not just in a I need to get heady or something kind of moment. It was more just finding how I feel about music, creating that emotion in a weird way. And I was able to somehow wrangle that with the help of many others.
So is part of the difference here, it's on the one hand, Josh alone in a hotel room or apartment in Chicago versus Josh in a studio with musicians you're comfortable with?
Maybe, yeah. Every time I would go, as I was saying, when I recorded for a week at a time, at the studio, every time I would go home from those kinds of things, everything just started to pour out again. And so I think the kernels of each song definitely start with me alone. And they kind of have to be, this is such a private event for me personally anyways, but I'm learning more and more that it doesn't always have to be that way. Things can be spontaneous and things can just happen, whether that's by myself or in a more communal, environment.
Now, listening to some of the songs of the album, I'm thinking, oh, this is a studio track. You can't really do that live. And then I watch a video or you perform here in Buck's studio. I think, oh, that's how we do it. Is it a challenge to translate the studio takes into performing them live?
Yes, I think so. Yeah. It was kind of intimidating at first. We didn't have any parameters for this record. So we didn't, this is, before kind of any kind of label kind of interest or anything. So we had all this time to just create this mammoth, thing. And, when we started getting the band together, it was at first whoa, we're going to have to really kind of dial in what is the essential ingredients to each song. But, I've surrounded myself here with amazing musicians that are able to capture the essence and kind of what we do with the record. But I think the songs are in kind of that long form kind of thing that we can always kind of retranslate what we need to say in each song every time we play the song. So they constantly change in life. Settings.
Talk about touring. How widely are you touring now that the album is out?
Just got going. Our first tour was this huge, mammoth, weird UK tour, Paris with this guy Ben Howard. And so we were, our first tour, pretty much playing for 10,000 seat arenas, which is pretty
wow.
Surreal. So that was great for 3 weeks, and you jumped right back into that, into a small club U.S. tour, and it was right the next day, and so we got home and started doing that. But it was phenomenal all around, all parts of it, and I think taking all that time away, I'm hungrier than ever to be on the road, and so I think a lot of people my age are kind of burned out at certain places, but I feel like I'm
making up for lost time.
Yeah, exactly.
Bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
I got rain on tin.
That Eau Claire scene we've been talking about converging at this big music festival, the Eau Claire's.
Yeah.
Still not clear exactly on how to pronounce
that's
it.
Right.
Festival.
That's right. It might not sound right, but that's right.
So what are you're playing there.
Yep.
What are you looking for, apart from your own set, what are you looking forward to seeing there?
I think it's just, in a weird way, Vern's curated all of his friends to come together, and these are all our friends, And so I think I've ever been in a place where everyone from our scene is all coming together in one place. Pretty much every single person from the family tree of Eau Claire is going to be playing this thing in some form or the other. And I think that's just going to be really inspiring and amazing to see all of these people coming together in one. No one would have ever predicted this kind of thing. But we've had, there's always been one-offs and there's been little festivals and everyone gets together. But this festival is every single person that I've ever played music with or have been passionate about from there, you know, friends on friends on friends that are all coming together. And I think that's just an amazing thing. I think it's pretty unprecedented for any kind of music festival.
So you're touring still. You've got the recent album out. Mm-hmm. What's next? What's in the works?
We're going to be going out quite a bit, back to Europe a couple more times this fall, and probably a U.S. tour. We're going to be doing Basilica Block Party in Minneapolis, and then Eau Claire's, and then out for a few weeks. But it'll be pretty like road heavy the rest of the year, while finding time to see girls and wives and things like that.
All right, well, enjoy the road, and thanks a lot for coming up to Buck Studio.
Cheers, yeah. I love your show. It's great.
That was Arrow Flynn. They'll be playing the inaugural Eau Claire's Music Festival on July 18th. You can catch them at the Frequency in Madison on July 20th. You can go to arrowflynn.org for a complete list of the band's tour dates.
Our Setlist Summer Music Series airs on Central Time Fridays at 4:15 through early September. For more about Arrow Flynn and other featured artists, including songs and videos of their exclusive performances at our WPR studio, head over to wpr.org/setlist.
Next Friday on Setlist will feature Field Report, a Milwaukee band that's toured in support of artists like Jeff Tweedy, Amy Mann, and Counting Crows.
I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
A week ago today, Wisconsinites woke up to find out that in a last-minute addition to the state budget, Republicans on the Joint Finance Committee had approved changes that would significantly weaken the state's open records law.
The media responded with heavy coverage, and lawmakers and activist groups across the political spectrum spoke out against the open records plan. By Friday, the governor's spokeswoman said changes would be made to the proposal, and on Saturday, lawmakers and the governor said they would drop the plan.
The story doesn't quite end there, though. GOP lawmakers and the governor said the proposed changes would instead be considered in a legislative committee. Jessica McBride is a senior journalism lecturer at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. In a recent piece at onmilwaukee.com, she argues that even though the open records plan is out of the budget, a lot of questions still remain about how it got there in the first place and its future. Jessica McBride, welcome to Central Time.
How are you? Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, in that piece we mentioned, you wrote that in the past you've supported Republicans on some controversial issues, things like Act 10 and school choice, other things, but you were not happy about this one. This is a very critical piece about the open records access proposal. What is it that got you about this?
Well, you know, I never felt that open government was a partisan issue in this state, and we have a very strong open records and open meetings law, and it dates back to the foundation of our state, the founding of Wisconsin. In fact, 1 year after Wisconsin became a state, you know, the government included a requirement for county clerks and sheriffs to open, quote, for the examination of any person, end quote, all of their records. So this is a principle that I thought, you know, both sides, if you want to call it that, agreed was very important. And so that's number one. I just don't see it as a partisan issue. I see it as a good government issue that we should all be concerned about. And I wasn't the only, you know, person who sometimes supports Republicans who felt that way. What was really striking, I thought, about this debate was how it united liberals, conservatives, independents in immediate outcry. And I don't think the legislature and the governor expected that. You know, they got as much hue and cry and criticism from the right as they did from the left. I would say another point is that as a journalist, you know, I was a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel for more than a decade. And as a journalism instructor, I've used the open records law extensively in investigative reporting. I teach it to my students. And so I just know the importance of it, not for the media per se, but for the citizenry to be informed about how decisions are made by government. I thought conservatives were against big government, you know, and to me this is sort of big government at its worst, especially the process of how it was done.
And to sum up for us, what would have changed? What kind of access would have been lost under this proposal?
Well, what they were really trying to do here was restrict what would be called deliberative process documents. So they were trying to shield from public, you know, scrutiny and view, you know, documents that reveal what was going on and how bills are made and who's influencing legislation and basically the process of government before the final outcome. And in the current laws, you know, there is some restriction allowed for what would be called notes or drafts. You know, if you're just some legislator and you're sitting at home and you're scribbling some notes that only you see, like, I can't get that as a journalist or as a citizen. But once you share that information currently, you know, that's open to public access. So I'll give you an example. All of this reporting that was going on with the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, excellent reporting about these sketchy loans and, you know, they're being, you know, proposed by members of the governor's administration, and then there were other staffers who were weighing in on them and killing some of them and approving others, and sort of all of that deliberative process and the documentary evidence about it, that's the kind of thing that they wanted to say it's secret and nobody can see. It went farther than that, but that's the core of it. They would also protect, you know, information when constituents would contact legislators. You wouldn't be able to get that kind of document anymore. And why that concerned people is, you know, who's a constituent? You know, and people brought up this case where a Republican donor had, you know, been involved in actually writing the draft of changes to child support legislation. So people say, wait a minute, you know, does he count? He's a constituent. That's the kind of thing we won't get to learn about anymore. So in a nutshell, those are the key things. There are a few other things thrown in. And a key point I think a lot of people forget, too, is this wouldn't just have applied to the legislature. It would have applied to school boards, to your local, you know, common council, to the governor's office.
We're talking to Jessica McBride. She is a senior journalism lecturer at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. Our topic now, open records access in Wisconsin. This got a lot of coverage, a lot of angry reaction, as she said, across the political spectrum. An effort added in a late document into the state budget by the Joint Finance Committee, limiting access to records. A lot of different records. She was just laying out a lot of the basics there. We want to hear from you on this issue at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What was your reaction when you heard about this effort? Is this something that worries you? Do you think that at least one of these maybe is worth considering? The idea of, in certain cases, concealing the identity of constituents who make contact with state legislators. Are you worried or hopeful that changes might be still to come in a legislative committee? 800-642-1234 is a number. And Jessica, I want to key in on that one point. One of the topics you mentioned, some lawmakers have said, hey, what we really wanted to do was protect the identity of constituents.
Right.
Some of those constituents might be Representative Nygren, who's on with us today talking about a different issue, but he said, hey, I've done heroin legislation, and some families have contacted me about that and want to keep their family story private. Would there be worthwhile changes to make to protect the identity in those cases?
Well, you know, here's where I come down on that. And first of all, this argument about constituent privacy, it was put out there. This is our driving reason for having done this. But the actual legislation went much beyond that. So I fail to see how constituent privacy, for example, relates to documents that illustrate Governor Walker's involvement in revising the Wisconsin IDEA, you know, for example. And those are documents that right now his office is involved in a lawsuit, and he's actually blocked release of those documents using the same argument the legislature was trying to pass here. I think that's fascinating. A lot of people are missing that point. Let me repeat that. The governor's office is currently blocking records using the same argument that he's running around publicly criticizing the legislature for trying to codify in state law. There's actually a lawsuit relating to those documents. So it went much farther than constituent privacy. Now, I would acknowledge that good people could have a vigorous debate about constituent privacy. I mean, the open records laws throughout our history in Wisconsin have been revised. You know, often they're revised to expand the public's rights to see documents and obtain them. In other cases, you know, there were restrictions restrictions put on the law. And so I don't think anyone would argue that we should never talk about the limits of the open records law. And maybe Representative Nygren has a point. But what I would say to that is then we should look at how flawed the process was and how they went about doing this. They put this into this notorious 999, you know, omnibus motion in the Joint Finance Committee. They did it right before a holiday, late at night, without any public input. They didn't give the public a chance to have that thorough, vigorous debate before 12 Republicans on the Joint Finance Committee decided to vote for this. So I think that's really troubling, you know, how they did that. There's sort of two issues, the principle of the matter, the content of this, and then there's the process.
Let's go to a caller now. We've got Jacob on the line with us in Burlington. Jacob, hi.
Yeah, I'm fascinated at the cloak of secrecy about the source of all this yet, and who is investigating that? I've asked my state senator, Senator Nass, to investigate that, and I think there should be some questions about censoring or slaps in the wrist for legislators on that committee who did this type of thing.
Jacob, thanks for the call. And Jessica, your piece was about unanswered questions about this. This was one of them. Who, who initiated it? Do we have an answer to that
yet? Well, we got an answer, sort of, I would say, about a day after I first wrote that piece. And I thought this was very disturbing. So initially, Governor Walker dodged the question about whether he knew about this in advance and whether he or his staff had been involved in this. He literally didn't answer the question. He said something like, well, things float around the Capitol all the time, and, you know, we're going to talk more about this on Monday. Well, then what happened is Scott Fitzgerald, the leader of the Republicans in the Senate, actually outed the governor to the media. I mean, I have to give him a lot of credit, though, for having candor. I mean, I don't understand why this was so secret in the first place. That's very troubling. And Fitzgerald came out and said, well, actually, Governor Walker and his staff, they were involved in this process. At that point in time, the governor, through a spokeswoman, came out and admitted it, that he was involved in developing this and his office was involved. Today, he went on talk radio and he called it a huge mistake. But what I thought was very interesting, first of all, he tried to cast blame back at the legislature and said, oh, it originated with them, even though, yes, my office was involved. But secondly, he said it was a huge mistake that it had been put in the budget, because obviously this is a non-fiscal matter. It was stuck in the budget in this strange process. But then he said, oh, it's good that it's going to be going to this committee. So, I mean, I just want to point out again, this is not dead. And Walker's not going as far as, say, Republican Attorney General Brad Schimmel did, who correctly, in my opinion, trashed this and said it was wrong and the open records laws are a cornerstone of democracy, you know, period. Instead, Walker's hedging. You know, he's sort of saying, well, it shouldn't have been in the budget, but I'm glad it's before this committee. So we'll see with that. In terms of who was involved in the legislature, I mean, the legislative leadership of the Assembly and the Senate have now, after a lot of hue and cry, come out and they said, yeah, we were involved, the governor was involved, it was collaborative involvement. But I don't think anyone said, you know, here's the one person who came up with this or who pushed it the most. And, you know, I thought it was shocking how some of the legislators actually were walking away from reporters and refusing to answer this question of who was behind this for days, really.
We're talking with Jessica McBride, senior lecturer of journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She says while GOP lawmakers have struck that these open records changes from the state budget, questions remain about the future of transparency in the state and the motivations behind the change in the first place.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the proposed open records changes? What do you think about last-minute additions of non-fiscal items to the state budget? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We are continuing our conversation with Jessica McBride, senior lecturer of journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. We're talking about the GOP's proposal that would have dramatically weakened open records laws in the state.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions and your questions or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go right back to our callers with Jocelyn in Sheboygan. Jocelyn, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm just wondering, considering all the facts that have come out since Walker was elected, I'm just wondering if this open records has anything to do with them trying to hide from the John Doe, or would it have affected the John Doe investigation?
Jocelyn, thanks for the call. Jessica McBride.
That's actually a really good point. I made this argument in my column for iMilwaukee.com that this was basically the legalized version of the secret router, if you know what I'm talking about. The secret router was this scheme in the Milwaukee County Executive's office that circumvented open records law. And what it involved was deliberative process, you know, people communicating about the operations of government and the development of you know, provisions that eventually might get a vote. And it was very revealing. In fact, it led to criminal convictions against some Walker subordinates for, among other things, doing blatant campaign fundraising using tax dollars. Now, these documents came to light because the media sued and under the argument that they should have always been public record. And a judge agreed with the media and ordered the release of these. So if you remember all these John Doe document dumps, like, that's why they were released. Well, what I think's interesting is that had this provision been in place at the time, you wouldn't have gotten those documents because they would have been secret, and that's interesting. And I think it's important to note, too, that Governor Walker has never answered the question of whether he knew about the secret router. He dodged it. I mean, he actually said that it was old news, and so he wouldn't answer the question. I think it would be interesting if the media doubled back and asked him that question now, since he's going publicly and saying, you know, he cares so much about open records laws and transparency. And again, I just wanted to say that, you know, I believe in the principle of this. I mean, let me give you just a couple quick facts that I think show how embedded open governance is in Wisconsin's history. Back in 1856, there was actually a court decision that said wood and candles had to be provided so that a county clerk could light his office so that people could come in and review records. And the first statute on open records laws took place in 1917 in Wisconsin. The current laws took their present form in 1981 with, you know, extensive public input and debate. Over the years, you know, there were court decisions, there were other legislative controversies, and really the legislature in the past has erred on the side of you know, fixing problems in the open records law to allow for more transparency. I mean, there was a court decision, I'll try to boil it down, that had restricted a lot of records for a couple of years. It was called the Wozniacki decision, and it was about, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, something like that. The legislature stepped in, and they fixed that Wozniacki case to allow for records to be released again as they had before. So there's such a long history of this, again, in a nonpartisan or bipartisan way, that I just find it to be very surprising. And my last question in my column was, you know, what the heck were they thinking? I think that remains an unanswered question.
And Jessica, looking to the future, Governor Walker announcing his White House bid on Monday. Briefly, as we start to wrap up, is this something that could follow him into the national spotlight?
Well, I think, you know, it would have helped him in his presidential run had they gotten this through, and I think that's revealing because obviously there's going to be a lot of open records requests, and currently are, to find out about different things that he's done or been involved in as governor. You know, there's a lot more scrutiny on him. So I guess I would say in a sense it hurts him that there was this public hue and cry, because now there's going to be more transparency about how he's, you know, made decisions as governor, his involvement in things like the Wisconsin idea. And I'll give you one other example. The Department of Administration had denied open records requests. A citizen had asked for records relating to the IRIS program in Governor Walker's budget. He had proposed that be discontinued. It's a long-term care program that a lot of people use in the Milwaukee area. And they denied it using this deliberative process argument. So I think that's how it ties in. I mean, just in terms of, you know, a two-day news issue, I don't think it's going to have a big impact. I would also point out that Democrats are not always pure on this matter either. I mean, liberal legislator John Erpenbach had blacked out constituent names who had these people had written to him during the Act 10 era. And the conservative think tank, the MacIver Institute, had sued John Erpenbach to get that information.
And we'll have to leave it there. Jessica, thanks for joining us. That was Jessica McBride, senior lecturer in journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, talking about state Republicans' proposal to change the state's open records access law. You can continue the conversation on the Central Time Facebook page.
The legislature's final approval of a 20-week abortion ban comes just days before Governor Walker is expected to announce his bid for the presidency. Democrats say it's not a coincidence. Republicans insist it's not about politics. Shemaine Mills reports.
Governor Scott Walker said he'd announce his presidential bid after the state budget was passed, and it was earlier this week after lengthy debate. Undoubtedly still tired after a long night, lawmakers convened again less than 12 hours later. They took up a bill banning abortions after 20 weeks. Milwaukee Democrat Mandela Barnes.
Everybody's quiet. We just got done with the budget. Usually when you vote on the budget, you go on recess. But for some reason, we had to come back to debate this.
Governor Walker wasn't there, but his name came up a lot. He was mentioned repeatedly by Democrats as the force behind new abortion restrictions. Representative Todd Onstad of Kenosha.
This is just one more conservative talking point to be used by the governor in his bid for the extreme right wing in the presidential primaries.
Madison Democrat Therese Berceau criticized the governor for backing one of the most restrictive abortion laws in the country after softening his tone on abortion during his recall election.
So he was willing to, I'll be polite and say, obfuscate the truth or obfuscate and say that he believed it was a woman's decision to get votes. How crass is that? How crass is that? Now he wants more votes because he's running for president.
Joel Clayfish would have none of it. The Oconomowoc Republican said the abortion legislation has more to do with faith than politics.
And the other side today has accused us of being political. I'll tell you, this isn't political for us. It's personal. Those of us here, many of us do believe God decides when we come into the world and when we leave it.
Some lawmakers got personal during the debate. Marquesan Republican Joan Balwig.
When my son and daughter-in-law called and said, Mom and Dad, guess what? We're pregnant. It's a fetus. No, they said, we're going to have a baby.
But opponents of the bill say it could force women to carry a fetus that's destined to die because of abnormalities. La Crosse Democrat Jill Billings.
This is inserting ourselves into a difficult situation, less than 1% of abortions, where the women's health is in danger, very little possibility of a baby surviving at all. We should not be inserting ourselves in that situation. This is between a mother and her family and her doctor. We need to stay out of this.
Supporters of the bill say politicians have an obligation to get involved. Kewaskum Representative Jesse Kramer said lawmakers needed to stop what he called cruelty.
I implore all of you in this chamber today, if there is any possibility at all that a preborn child can truly feel pain at 5 months, are you willing to take that chance? This is not a red or a blue issue. This is an issue of humanity and morality.
After declaring it wasn't a political issue, Kramer voted for the ban, as did his Republican colleagues. Democrats all voted against it. The debate touched on medicine, faith, and women's rights, but the vote itself fell along party lines. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.